As a child growing up on his family's farm in the 1980s, Jerry Gettle didn't spend his evenings watching TV. He read seed catalogs. To him, the endless varieties of seeds with exotic-sounding names were full of possibility. He loved the idea of planting them and eventually preparing the harvested vegetables for a family meal. From that early fascination with seeds, Gettle has built a thriving business, the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. And now there's a book, The Heirloom Life Gardener. Gettle describes heirloom seeds as being passed down through the generations. They're usually more than 50 years old and are considered pure, not genetically modified.
They've basically been sitting in people's, backyards and their garages and their root cellars. They've just recently been rediscovered for the market. I mean, in the last 10 or 12 years, all of a sudden, every chef and every magazine is all of a sudden starting to talk about our agricultural past. And with that comes, the varieties that basically made America.
Well, you mentioned in your book that as a child, I think, or certainly as a teenager, when you were going through these catalogs, you started noticing that certain seeds were being left behind.
Yeah, probably about the time I was 10 or 12 years old, I started noticing seeds disappearing. That was, the late 80s and early 90s. And especially the 80s was a period when varieties were just being dropped randomly from catalogs for no reason other than they weren't the newest thing. And so, I started noticing things like the banana melon disappearing out of catalogs, which was an incredible melon. So it kind of inspired me to, start looking for varieties.
Well, I think what's most striking about the vegetables that are grown from these heirloom seeds is how different they look from what we're used to seeing in a grocery store.
They vary from everything that looks like a traditional grocery store variety, but the majority of them are different looking. Each one's unique, as were the families they came from. I mean, there's varieties from, African-American heritage here, Japanese varieties, German varieties, and each type comes with their own cultures, whatever they thought was greater, tasty, or good looking. So you have a lot of diversity.
What's the most interesting seed that you ever found? What's the most interesting story behind a seed that you discovered while you were traveling around the world?
Oh, there's so many different stories. And a lot of times, actually, when we're traveling, we don't get the full story because of language barriers. So some of them we've actually found, online as well, like the Yokohama squash. It was one that was brought to the United States in the 1860s. And it basically had disappeared out of commercial catalogs in the 1880s. And we thought it was extinct, and we finally found a grower in France that was still preserving it. It's a beautiful flattened pumpkin-shaped squash with a beautiful gray-green rind, and it kind of has a waxy look to it. One of the best eating of all the different squashes that we grow.
Right. You can travel all over the world to find seeds, but you also in the book explain how you can save seeds in your own kitchen.
That's correct. As long as you're planting the traditional varieties that aren't patented, you can save seed. Almost anything you grow, you can save seeds from as long as it's traditional. It's very easy, actually. It's a process that nature does every year.
You mentioned in the book that you attended an auction where buckets of heirloom vegetables were being sold for like $1,000, as if they were sort of a work of art. Does that bother you at all to see vegetables treated as if they're kind of precious relics, as I think you put it in the book?
I think it's exciting, to see that, the support behind heirlooms. Anything to create awareness of where our food comes from, the varieties and the history behind it all is, definitely anything that can encourage that we're for.
But do you want to put those vegetables in their place right back on the family dinner table as opposed to in an art house auction?
Definitely that's what we're behind, and that's actually what the auction was behind as well. It was, to raise money and create awareness. It's definitely what's happening right now across America. I mean, farmers markets have, tripled in the last 10 or 12 years in the United States. And fortunately for heirloom varieties, they've become kind of the stars at each farmer's market.
Jerry Gettle, he and his wife Emily are the authors of the new book, The Heirloom Life Gardener. Thanks so much for joining us, Jerry.
Thank you and have a great day.
You can find a list of Gettle's tips for how to save seeds in your own kitchen in an excerpt on our website, npr.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Smith. I know the show isn't over, but I do think it is time for a little dessert and time to leave the studio for a few minutes. destination Manhattan.
I'm here on the streets of the East Village, where there is no shortage of dessert options. In fact, I can look around here on this corner of 11th Street and 1st Avenue and see desserts as far as the eye can see. But we are not here to eat just any dessert. We are here to answer a question. Where did dessert come from? And I'm standing with?
Michael Crondall.
Michael Crondall is a food historian and the author of the new book,
Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert.
I presented a challenge to Michael Crondall. Find me the oldest dessert in New York City. And I'm not talking about the rock-hard donuts on the coffee cart on the corner, but the kind of dessert they might have eaten 500, 1,000, 2,000 years ago. We started our quest at Vigneros, an Italian pastry shop, to see what they might have been eating in the Middle Ages.
Let's get some pignoli cookies. Let's also get some ladyfingers.
Okay, ladyfingers, where are those? Oh, I see them right there.
Then the biscotti, the almond ones.
We made two more stops for even older treats, and we brought our sugary haul back here to the studio. But before we eat, what exactly do we mean by the concept of dessert?
Well, the whole idea of dessert as something at the end of the meal is a pretty recent invention, but the idea of sweet snacks, something that is primarily sweet that you might have in the middle of a meal, or you might have outside of a meal, or you might have at the end of a meal, goes back, well, to the days when we started to sit down or perhaps recline, and to the days when sugar was something exceptional, something that only the very, very wealthy could afford. And as a result, they had the best stuff, and the best stuff was sweet.
All right, let's open up the box here. They've put in a nice box tied with twine. Oh, and they've wrapped everything up individually. I'm feeling something hard here.
Oh, what you have there is biscotti. Now, biscotti were not invented in Seattle to go along with Starbucks, believe it or not.
These are these little hard cookie-like slices of bread, usually sweet with often nuts in them.
Yep. And those, well, originally when you used to go sailing, right, everything would rot on the ship. You'd need it to last a long time. And so they made something called biscotto, which was bread that you bake, and then you cut it up and you'd bake it one more time. Eventually, what they started to do was they started to make cake, cut it up, and bake it one more time. Biscotto means literally twice baked. And that, well, it's a little hard to know how far back that goes because there's some reference to fine biscotti from about the 13th century, but we don't really know what that means. So the real recipes, the first real recipes for what you could identify as biscotti come from about 1550 or so. And there you've got more or less what you have in your hand, which is a mixture of flour, sugar, and nuts.
Can hear it crackle as I break it in half. Nice little almond biscotti. I feel like I've tasted the best that Italy had to offer in the Renaissance and the Middle Ages. But in order to go back farther than that, I have to go back to
the Middle East.
To the Middle East. We went to a little cafe, and I'm going to let you say the name of this because it's Turkish.
And I'm going to mispronounce it horribly, but I'll give to take a stab at it. It is Gulu Olu. That's my best guess.
We had someone say it at the actual cafe.
Gulli Olu. Yeah, Gulli Olu.
And I am opening the box here. This Turkish cafe we stopped at specializes in baklava, and we have at least five different kinds here.
This particular company, Gulli Olu, comes from a part of Turkey where they're really well known for their pistachios. And when you taste it, you'll notice that these pistachios have this complex, interesting flavor.
Oh, it's excellent. It's you can taste, you can sort of, as your teeth move through all the little flaky layers, you can taste each and every one of them. It's great. I'm going to have to wipe my fingers off here because as anyone knows who has tried baklava, they are sticky. Now, we are eating Turkish baklava, but I know this is controversial because baklava was spread by the Ottoman Empire around the Mediterranean, into Central Asia, really, and every country claims it as their own.
Well, one of the interesting things about doing this sort of archaeology, you know, the archaeology where you dig through layers of baklava instead of layers of dirt, is that you discover that civilizations have a half-life, and you can find that half-life, well, in the form of baklava, for example. So you can pretty well find the traces of an empire that ceased to exist, what, almost 100 years ago? by going to all the countries that have baklava. And of course, now everybody says it's their own. Greeks claim that baklava is their own. Georgians have baklava. You find baklava in Iran. All these places have baklava. And I'm not someone who's going to say who invented it because I don't want to get into trouble. But it's all connected through this one particular political unit that existed once upon a time.
I'm speaking with author Michael Crondall, who has written the new book Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Well, now that we've moved through the layers of baklava, we need to dig deeper in this archaeological tour of desserts. We need to find the place whence sugar came from, because they didn't invent it in the Middle East, did they?
They certainly didn't. Where sugar, well, sugar wasn't invented, it was grown, right? But where they invented the idea of refining sugar was definitely India. Everyone pretty well agrees about that.
So India, we're talking, they were eating sugary desserts how long ago?
India, maybe 2,000, 2,500 years ago, something like that.
And you say in your book that this wasn't for everyday eating. This was almost a religious item at first.
This was food of the gods. This was food of the gods because to boil all that sugar down, to refine it, was outrageously expensive. And often what they did was they would combine it with various milk products. And as you can imagine, in India, milk goes bad, right? So they figured out all sorts of ways of preserving it. In Europe, the way they figured out to preserve cheese was to add salt. In India, it seems, they figured out that if they boiled down the milk with sugar, they would preserve it.
So we picked up this assortment of Indian treats. What do you think is most like what we would have been eating 2,000 years ago?
Probably the closest thing to that would be something called barfi.
Barfi, which one's that?
Barfi is this one. And no, barfi is made in all sorts of ways. It's sort of like, well, you tell me what you think it tastes like.
Okay. It is intensely sweet, dense. It's one step removed from just sugar pressed into a little ball.
It really, I think, tastes a lot like fudge.
Yeah. In ancient India, would we have been seeing anything fried, anything like a donut? I see like a little, looks like a little fried ball of something here.
It's unclear how far the fried desserts go. There's definitely fried desserts as far back as, oh, let's say, 1,000 years ago. One of the ancient holy liquids was ghee, that is clarified butter. And so how do you make something holier? Well, you fry it in one of the holy substances.
So luckily, if you think sugar and milk and oil are all holy objects.
Yeah, holy donut is it. Yeah.
Yeah, you've pretty much invented the holy donut. Michael Crondall is a food historian and the author of the new book, Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Thank you so much for going on the quest and eating with me.
It's been an over-the-top delight.
Over-the-top is the correct word there. Thanks.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. We were tickled this week to read some tips in New York Magazine about fine wines and fancy cheese. It wasn't a story laying out the difference between the Brunello and Chianti grape or between goat and sheep's milk cheese. No, it was a set of tips for faking it as a food connoisseur. The advice came from someone who ought to know, Alton Brown, host of Iron Chef America on the Food Network. And he joins me now. Alton Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And first on your list, how to fake it as a wine connoisseur. What are your tips?
Well, you know, when you go into a restaurant, one of the scariest things is the wine list. So whenever I'm really feeling intimidated, I'll just pick a wine type, like a Chianti or a Brunello or a Burgundy, and I'll pick a year that's missing and ask for that one. And then when they try to off-sell me to another year, I debate that the weather wasn't very good that year and that maybe they could make another suggestion. You know, in the end, you have to remember that wine folks, you know, sommeliers are full of knowledge that they want to show off above all. So the goal is to let them show off while making it look like you kind of deserve their best act. And so asking harmless questions is always really, really good. And occasionally I'll make reference to having had several other bottles that I see on the list and then kind of let them go from there. So that makes it look like you know something that when you actually can't even pronounce the words right.
Okay, that's wine. What about cheese? How do you fake it with fancy cheese?
Well, the first thing you would do is if you can see the cheese, that's always good. You know, T.S. Eliot said, never consume a cheese without first having examined it. And I'm a really big proponent of that.
T.S. Eliot said that?
Yeah, he did. You can look it up.
You
can Google it. If you ask to see the cheese, that's always good. And it shows that you know enough to recognize quality of cheese. And then what I do is I say, okay, here's what I would love for you to do. Put together for me a cow's cheese, a sheep cheese, and a goat cheese. I want one that's firm, one that's only lightly aged, and one that's fresh. Can you do that? And they'll say, oh, well, certainly, sir. And then you say, but now I want them all to be American. Oh, and that'll just freak them out even more. So if you make it a riddle, that lets them show off their knowledge. So what I always do is I always order an odd number of cheeses because it looks best on the plate. I always ask for cow, goat, sheep, and I always ask one of them to be either blue-veined or wrapped in something mysterious looking like ashes because that just looks good on the plate.
Now, Alton Brown, you were named, if I have this right, Bon Appetit's Cooking Teacher of the Year in 2004?
Well, 2004 was a long time ago, but I do seem to remember that, yes.
Okay. Well, you would assume then that your preference would be that people actually learn stuff, know what they're talking about,
absolutely,
rather than faking it.
I would rather people actually learn. And there's absolutely nothing, unless you're really trying to impress somebody, there's absolutely nothing wrong with simply pleading, ignorance in these situations. I only really fake it anymore with sommeliers who are being really snotty to me, and I don't want to take their grief. And so I try to do something to kind of throw them off or put them on the defensive, even if I don't know what I'm talking about.
We've been pretty highbrow on our list here, Alton. But what about your favorite lowbrow food that requires just no faking whatsoever on your part?
I'm an absolute connoisseur of cheeseburgers and like to think that I can detect even mere percentages of shift in fat content and ground meat in a burger and can actually name the temperature to which it was actually cooked to the degree if I'm really on my game.
If anybody really wants to know.
If anybody really, really wants to know. It just goes to show how many hamburgers I've had, specifically cheeseburgers.
And it could be that your friends are just faking their interest in hearing your stories about cheeseburgers.
Now, that's just something I didn't need to think about. Come on. Melissa, you didn't need to do that. I mean, now I'm just going to be paranoid every time I start talking about cheeseburgers. Thanks for that.
Sorry. Alton Brown, the host of Iron Chef America. He's also the author of Good Eats 3, The Later Years. Alton Brown, thanks. Buon appetito.
Buon appetito to you.
And one last thing. We did Google that cheese quote from T.S. Eliot that Alton Brown mentioned. For the record, it actually goes like this. Never commit yourself to a cheese without having first examined it. Words to live by.
Walk down the produce aisle of your local grocery store. There are the button mushrooms, $4 a pound. The shiitakes, I don't know, about double that. If you live in a fancy neighborhood, maybe there are black truffles for $800 a pound. That is nothing. There's another fungus that can fetch as much as $50,000 a pound. But it's not for the flavor. Our producer, Lauren Silverman, went digging for some answers.
In English, it's called caterpillar fungus, but Asia knows it by the Tibetan term Yartsugumba, which means summer grass, winter worm. And although it is a fungus, it's not the kind you might find popping up in your backyard, unless your backyard is the Himalayas.
This fungus cordyceps, they make their living by getting inside of their host insect and ultimately killing it and consuming it.
That's Britt Bunyard, a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He's got a doctorate in fungus. So what he says this particular fungus does is take over the caterpillar's body and then erupt out of its head. And the result? A pinky-sized, mummified caterpillar with this kind of toothpick sticking out of the dirt. Britt Bunyard, who also created Fungi Magazine, says this is the most expensive one in the world.
The price doesn't compare to fungi. The price compares to things like gold and platinum and diamonds.
So why is it so expensive? Well, the fungus is also known as the Viagra of the Himalayas.
It is a faultless treasure of an ocean of good qualities.
The first mention of Yartsugumba is from a 15th century Tibetan medical text.
In particular, it increases especially semen.
And the price? Well, it all depends on size.
Size matters. So the bigger the worm, the higher the price.
That's Daniel Winkler. He grew up mushroom hunting in Germany and now spends a lot of time in Tibet. Yartsugumba has been popular for centuries in China, but he says the price has jumped by a factor of 10 over the past decade. These days, if you're a businessman in China trying to impress at dinner,
cook up some nice goose or duck or something and stuff it with a load of caterpillar fungus, and, you know, where the guest says or realizes, wow, I mean, this filling of the goose must be at least 500 or 1,000 bucks or something like that.
Because it is so valuable, Yurtsugumba has led to some violence. Last year in Nepal, 7 men went missing after a dispute over the fungus. 2 of them were found dead at the bottom of a ravine. That caught writer Eric Hansen's attention.
I said, what the heck is going on? What is this stuff?
Hansen is a freelance writer in New York. He's lived and traveled in Nepal, but never came across the prized fungus. So he tried to find it in New York City's Chinatown.
Sure enough, there it was. And in the first herbal apothecary I went into, there were 4 big glass jars of the stuff selling for between 500 and 1,300 bucks an ounce.
Hansen was so enthralled by this worm that he went back to Nepal.
As soon as they see that Yurtsugumba is sprouting in these high, high alpine fields, the whole village just empties out. And then everybody climbs up into the mountains and spends pretty much 6 weeks crawling around looking for the tips of Yurtsugumba.
A good harvest can triple an individual's income and completely transform communities, like the village of Nar.
The whole town used its Yurtsugumba profits to buy solar panels. So now you have this centuries-old stone hamlet, and on the corner of each building is a black solar panel about the size of a board game.
Here in the U.S., Yurtsugumba hasn't caught on. Mushroom hunter Daniel Winkler.
It's just too expensive. You really gotta believe it does something for your health.
Which is exactly what the fungus doctor, Britt Bunyard, is skeptical about.
There's no, to my knowledge, pharmaceutical companies in, say, the United States that have looked into this or currently are looking into this. There's just nothing that's been found out.
So I asked Eric Hansen, who tried the stuff in Nepal, if it did anything for him.
Nothing. My back pain didn't ease. My eyesight didn't sharpen. I didn't feel like springing out of my chair and taking a jog. My loins were not aflame and my libido did not rage.
But so long as Yurtsugumba is all the rage in China, there are still fungal fortunes to be made. Lauren Silverman, NPR News.